and welcome people also watching on the live stream at the Washington Note, Steve Clemens's blog, and we're going out on that blog live as well. And to welcome you to, I think it's the first meeting I've hosted in our new new premises, our new facility here at the New America Foundation. And it's really easy to know now where we are. And to thank you for joining us this this Thursday afternoon. I want to introduce my colleague Amjad, but also our guest here today, Alastair Crook. And as you'd have noticed, and this will be the main part of Alastair's opening presentation, the book that's on sale outside, and that part of Alastair's visit here in the United States is to discuss this book, Resistance, the Essence of the Islamist Revolution. I know Alastair Crook from some years ago, when his main focus as the special security advisor to the EU High Representative Javier Solana and working on their team, Alastair was in Israel, in the Palestinian territories, part of that team, and very focused for much of the period that Alastair was there and that I knew him on the Second Intifada, ceasefires during the Second Intifada, maintaining channels to all the Palestinian factions who at several times were brought into those ceasefires. Prior to that position with the EU, Alastair had an illustrious career involved in various conflicts, working out of the UK. And I think it's only given that you were involved with South Africa, Northern Ireland, I think Cambodia, Afghanistan, certainly, that today when home is Beirut, that as you told me this morning, your actual home is on Sniper's Corner, which is probably the only place someone like Alastair could choose to live. What Alastair does today is that he's a director of something called Conflicts Forum. He was also the founder of Conflicts Forum. It's an NGO which engages more broadly with Islamist movements. As I said, Alastair is now based out of Beirut. He travels frequently across the region, spending a lot of time amongst other places in Iran. Part of the work of Conflicts Forum is to bring together former and, in the European side, current officials and parliamentarians with those Islamist movements, including Hezbollah and Hamas, who they're in conversation with. I'm going to just mention one other part of Alastair's background, which probably would interest people, is that during that period with Solana in the region, Alastair was a senior advisor and staffer to the Sharm el-Sheikh Fact-Finding Commission, otherwise known as the Mitchell Committee, from in late 2000 and in 2001, that produced that report in 2001. Now, Alastair's going to really talk about the main theme of the book, which is going at kind of 30,000 feet, looking at the challenge in conceptual and thinking terms that the Islamist revolution posed to a Western way of thinking how it organizes about or thinks about organizing the world, and where that came from and what that means today, so as not to disappoint people who want to get into the nitty-gritty of what should we do about Hamas tomorrow and what's going on in the Lebanese elections and what else is going on in the region that we need to be thinking about, that your contacts with those movements should be informing us. We're going to get into that extensively in the Q&A, and Alastair will keep his opening presentation relatively brief to give a lot of time for that. Amjad Atallah, who's my colleague here and co-director of our Middle East Task Force here at the New America Foundation, and someone, we were all there at the same time, and someone who also knows Alastair from that time. Amjad's going to comment briefly on Alastair's presentation, and then we'll be opening it up. So I'm going to ask Alastair to join us and thank Alastair for giving some of us, some of your time while you're here to being with us.
Well, good morning. Thank you very much for coming today. On transiting from Beirut here to Washington, I stopped briefly in London and I picked up a leading foreign policy magazine. the newsstand, something rather like the magazine Foreign Policy here in the States. In other words, quite a serious document, a serious magazine. And it was marking the 30th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. And I opened the leading article on it, and it described how essentially the Islamic Revolution had come about from a problem that had emerged in the bazaar and the merchant classes of the bazaar of Tehran and their relationship with the Shah at that time. I was really shocked to read that 30 years after the Iranian Revolution, it is still possible that serious magazines in the West still see the Iranian Revolution in these terms as an economic hiccup, a slight mismanagement by the Shah of the delicate relations that he had between himself and the merchants of the bazaar in Tehran. Is it really the case that after all this time that we imagine that the energy and the excitement of the tens of millions of people that have been energized by this event, both in Iran and throughout the region, was simply an economic hiccup that arose in the merchant class of Tehran? And I think it underlines, and I mention it because what I think it does underline very clearly is it still seems extremely difficult for people to get an understanding or feel they understand what is both the Islamist as well as the Islamic resistance as a whole. And why is there, if you like, a revolution? And why is there a resistance that has emerged? And what brought it about? And I think when we look at these articles, it's plain that there seems to be still a problem in actually understanding or feeling of what actually caused it and what is this about, that it is put in such terms, if you like, of a historicist, a deterministic view, that it must really be something about some sort of economic turmoil that brought it into existence at that time. Well, I suppose there are probably as many definitions about what the Islamist revolution is as there are Muslims. But I'm going to nonetheless attempt a definition in order to give some idea of what I'm going to talk about. And I think that what I would describe as the essence of the Islamist revolution is a refusal, a passionate refusal by Muslims to accept the understanding of themselves and the world around us that is dominated by secular Western material consciousness. It is indeed an attempt to escape from the fundamental presuppositions, the deeply seated presuppositions of this worldview that has motivated the Islamist revolution, and to try and find an alternative consciousness that does escape from certain of these presuppositions and also which can provide an alternative view both of the human being and of the world in which we inhabit, a different, an alternative consciousness. The point of this, essentially, is that the revolution, therefore, the Islamist revolution, I believe is quite capable of a reasoned explanation, of a historical explanation. In short, it is not something that is an irrational kick against modernity by people who are incapable or reluctant to understand modernity, nor is it some whimsical Islamically inspired violence against the West. It is, I believe, an entirely rational outcome of events. And the root of this, essentially, as I described in terms of a reaction against modern secular consciousness, and the roots of this modernity lie, I believe, in two key pillars. The first one, of course, our historians remind us, has been called over the years the Great Transformation. The Great Transformation that took place in Europe in the 18th century. The Great Transformation that actually began initially in Britain and then extended to Europe and, of course, emerged in America also. And the Great Transformation was associated with a particular moral view of the world that had emerged out of Protestantism in England in that time. And it was about the idea of the invisible hand and how the invisible hand allowed markets and people to pursue their own personal interests and their own personal concept of their interests through the intersection and the mediation of the market, that this intersection allowed people's personal interests in the cumulative total to work to be towards the welfare of humanity as a whole. In aggregate, the intersection of the market provided not only the most effective distribution of goods and affairs, but also was to the interests and the welfare of humanity as a whole. It didn't happen spontaneously. It was not far from something that emerged naturally in Britain during the end of the 18th century. In fact, historians are fairly clear that it would be almost impossible to find the ideas of effective and efficient markets taking place in an era where there was democracy or popular participation politics. It took enormous and huge state intervention to bring about those efficient markets that the invisible hand suggested would maximize human welfare. But the key element, and the key element politically of the Great Transformation, was the decision, nonetheless, to put market efficiencies as the overriding objective of society and politics, to which other social, communal, and political objectives were subordinate. The second element, and the second pillar of modernity, which was closely associated with this idea of the invisible hand, was an idea also that arose out of the Protestant tradition in Europe, of a spontaneous natural order to society, of politics. If only politics could be left to itself, it would naturally emerge through, in a similar way to the market, the jostling of interest groups and communities together would produce a form of stability and order in society that had its own natural roots. Through the invisible hand. And it was out of these ideas, of course, that stemmed most of our ideas about the nation state. Because, of course, these Protestant and Puritan ideas were brought through people like James Paine to the United States. And the very character of United States government has been shaped by the idea of competing elements of the executive, the legislature, the judiciary, between the two, the Congress and the Senate, and the interest groups all providing, if you like, as some of the early drafters of the American Constitution noted, something broadly similar to what they saw as this ideal of the competitive society producing a natural order out of these balance of interests and balance of powers within the societies. These were the two pillars, and out of those, as I say, came also the idea of a nation state and human rights. And they have held sway for nearly 300 years in the world. I've had enormous grip in terms of being ideas of enormous strength and power throughout 300 years of their existence. They also, at the point, brought Islam to the brink of extinction. By the 1920s, Islam was effectively holding on by its fingernails. It was just about able to exist. And the reason for this was that the great transformation had come to Muslim societies. the great transformation took place and been brought by the West to Muslim societies in that period from the 1820s to the 1920s. In those 100 years, we saw this huge growth of nation-state building that took place. In terms of the Ottoman Empire, in the western provinces of the Ottoman Empire, 5.5 million Muslims were ethnically cleansed as part of the process of creating unitary, ethnically clear nation-states, centralized, efficient nation-states on the modern version. There were swaps of population, Muslims, Muslim Greeks with Christian Greeks. And there was the biggest change in population that took place in the effort to leverage nation states throughout the Baltics and the western provinces of the Ottoman area at that period. But of course, the prime example of the nation state making that took place, of trying to create a strong and powerful nation state. And why a strong and powerful nation state? Because it was believed that only a powerful nation state could bring about the changes that would allow modern economics, the efficiency of markets, both politically and social, to work effectively. Took place in Turkey. And of course, you will all recall that in bringing about a modern nation state in that light involved the massacre of 1 million Armenians, and it involved the killing of 250,000 Assyrians. It involved the swaps of population, ethnic cleansing, and it brought about also the destruction of the Kurdish identity. And finally, at the end of the period of Ataturk, it brought about the demise of the caliphate and Islamist identity in Turkey as well. By the 1920s, Islamism was under pressure, both from secularization, not just in Turkey, but in Egypt, and in, of course, in Persia too. And from the bottom up, it was being attacked by the ideas of Marxism. Marxism throughout the region was attracting and drawing more and more young people. Islam, at that stage, by the 1920s, was in profound crisis. It was in deep crisis and hanging on by its fingernails. And it embarked on a journey to try and rediscover, to find a new self, to rediscover itself, and to find from that discovery solutions to the problems that it faced. And in this way, it followed a path that Christianity had similarly taken in Western Europe, in the Dark Ages of Europe, after the fall of the Roman Empire, when Christianity, too, was hanging on by its fingernails in a few monasteries of parts of Western Europe, and also similarly had to go through a voyage of self-discovery, of trying to reinvent a new self. And it did it in the case of Christianity, through a process of monasticism and pilgrimage to Jerusalem that took place at the end of the 11th century. But for Islam, the journey, of course, was clear. It was back to the roots and the roots of the Quran. I think all of you will know that the Quran, in fact, as a document, is no blueprint. It gives you no clear formula for life or no clear formula for a political or state organization. It never claims to that. In fact, it takes a rather negative view of theological reflection. It repeats time and time again that it offers nothing new, that in fact the Quran is a reminder to all human beings of old truths, old truths that we all know, but perhaps have forgotten. And one of those key truths is that for human beings to live together and to grow and to exist and to develop their potential, they need to live together, practicing the principles of compassion, equity, and justice. And this is seen not simply as a formula, a dogmatic formula, but it has two functions. It is a religious aspect that act unlike Christianity. Faith is not something that is a matter of conviction and belief, but can come through not only practicing these principles and these ideals, but living day to day in a society which reflects them, both in practice and being a recipient of those ideals. And that through this, living day to day through this type of society, human beings are believed to be able to get a glimpse of transcendence. But it is also, of course, about transforming people in terms of their behavior too. So it has a very clear political view. Out of this insight came what I believe is the revolutionary ideas of political Islam. And this is the key element, because on the one hand, as I described it, we had the great transformation. The great transformation of Europe, which of course had similarly, as has happened in the Middle East, not been without its crisis. It came about through massive force of state intervention to bring it into being. But from period to period, it led to crisis. It led in the 19th century to enormous crisis, and fundamentally in the beginning of the 20th century to revolution as part of the reaction to the social stresses that the great transformation had brought in Europe. And of course, as part of that, to the deaths of millions of Europeans, as well as what I've described as the deaths that took place in terms of some of these transformations in terms of the Western provinces of the Ottoman era. And so in contrast to the great transformation which put market efficiency, political and economic, it's the overriding objective to which other objectives were subordinate. Political Islam says the overriding objective is to create and construct a society that practice and acts on the basis of compassion, justice, and equity, to which market structures, which are perfectly swept away, but to which markets are subordinated and regulated according to the primary objective of creating a society that is compassionate, just, and equitable. And that other priorities must be subordinated to this great end. So it was a complete inversion, if you like, of the Western paradigm of modernity, and is a complete inversion. Not only is it revolutionary in political terms, and it is also revolutionary in another aspect. Sometimes you hear people say, well, this is just social democracy, isn't it? Is this something rather like social democracy? And the answer is it is not. It is clearly not, because social democracy is essentially based on an acceptance of the principles of market efficiency, political and economic, for which social democracy believes that there must be mitigate the worst aspects and the worst effects. For those who are least fortunate in society, there must be some form of system to prevent that taking place. Political Islam says the opposite, that you must make this the overriding priority to which markets must be regulated and subordinate to those interests of equity, justice. So that it is not about social democracy. It is also revolutionary in that the organizational principle of Western paradigm has been the individual for the last 300 years, the individual around whom politics, society, and economics must be constructed. And the implication of this model of political Islam is the inversion of that and putting the community and the health and the welfare of the community as a whole, taken as a whole, as the prime objective to that of individualism. So it is a revolution in thinking in terms of politics, and of course what it is in fact doing, and the essence of what the political Islam is doing, is challenging the West in precisely on the issue, is what is the end and what is the purpose of politics? It is going back to the very question that lies at the heart of all our civilizations, Plato's question that he posed to all of us and the Greek philosophers at that time. What actually is the purpose and the end of politics? And I make that point because I think it's very important that this is actually, in a sense, really one of the core of the questions. But the revolution, the Islamist revolution, is more than just this political insight I've just described. It is also, as I mentioned, an attempt to escape some of the deepest and most far-reaching presuppositions of our time. And therefore, that the Islamist revolution must be seen not simply as a political or a social event, but must also be understood as a philosophical challenge, but also it must be understood as a metaphysical outcome. A metaphysics, an aspect which, of course, for the last 200 years in the West has been something that has been relativized completely, almost out of political thinking. But what they have been trying to do has been an attempt to step out of these presuppositions of our society, our modernity, by stepping out of material causality itself, to provide a radically different understanding of a human being that is not split into its component parts, that is not just simply an aggregate of his social factors, his economic factors, his psychological factors, his chemical factors, and his genetic factors, but to see a human being in a different paradigm. And it is also a new form of finding politics through a revival of thinking in terms of the imaginal, about archetypal narrative, and about symbolism. This may seem a little unrealistic or far-reaching, if you like, when you put it in these terms. But it's very important to understand that actually that these are the tools of political transformation for movements like Hezbollah and other Islamic movements. That it is actually use of myth, use of archetype, that is the vehicle for providing a transformation, the use of archetypes that provides a transformation of behavior, of imagination, but particularly of consciousness. In other words, it is by these means that Islamists move from an understanding of the world and the world about them to a different understanding of the world about them through use of imagination and through symbol. And through archetype. For 300 years, they believe that they have been held by a scientific rationalism. When I asked recently a Hezbollah leader what was the most important thing that had emerged from the Iranian Revolution, he replied without hesitation, "For the first time, we were free to think for ourselves again." The ideas that I've just described are not exclusive to Islam. Some of them and many of them have been touched on in Western philosophy. The consequences in psychological and political terms of the segmented human being and the segmented society have been mentioned, of course, by Nietzsche, by Heidegger, by the Frankfurt School of Critical Thinkers. But many of those from a different standpoint and have often reached very pessimistic conclusions as a result of the secular base from which they started. But there are many, if you like, resonances in Western philosophy that closely accept some of these ideas that are emerging in political Islam. But more importantly, the idea about the human being can also be seen very clearly in many of the much of the present thinking in terms of depth psychology, archetypal psychology, and Jungian psychology today, which is traversing very similar track, albeit tracks that are not connected and are not feeding upon one another, but moving in parallel, not necessarily to exactly the same age, same end. But the point I'm making is that these ideas have been in the Islamic intellectual tradition for more than 1,000 years, and they reached and they came to fruition during the Islamic Revolution. And these are the ideas that are fueling the Islamist revolution, and that these are ideas that are profoundly about philosophy, about thinking, and about metaphysics. And it is important to understand that these are the basis of what is the Islamist revolution. And I think one of the reasons that it was so difficult when I started to understand what happened in Iran, and we just reduce it, if you like, to a few economic precursors that brought it about, is because it is frankly quite difficult to find the language in English to talk about the sort of political transformation that is taking place in a movement like Hezbollah when you talk about use of archetype, about myth, about a spirituality that brings about a different sense of consciousness. We simply have not have that vocabulary left after our great Cartesian split between the objective world and the world of unreason and irrationality. So I'm sure that many of you who have listened this far will be thinking to yourself, well then why? Why do we see in the Middle East and in the Muslim world intolerant and violent dogmatic Islam? Why do we see these, if this is about philosophy and about intellect, how do we see dogmatic, violent Islamist movements about? I think, if I had to give a very short answer, it is largely because the West has been creating them over the last 50 years. I don't mean that this has been I'm not about to present a Middle Eastern conspiracy theory, and I don't suggest that this is done intentionally, but this has been the outcome of the policies that we have used. Because apart from the revolution that I have described, of course, there is another current of political Islam, which I would describe as a counter-revolution of political Islam. A counter-revolutionary Islam, which is not like the one I've described, which is narrow, literalist, dogmatic, anti-heterodox. And it is that that is the counter-revolution that is both anti-philosophical and anti-rational in the process. In our template that the West has used for the last 50 years of moderates versus extremists, we have sought to use what we saw as an apolitical and docile form of political Islam in order to constrain and contain certain threats, including the Islamic revolution. And I believe that not only is that incorrect, but it also misidentifies the means and the way in which apolitical Islam can become and does become, in fact, not only a narrow and hating organization, but one which is profoundly dangerous too. It is, in fact, the misuse of apolitical Salafism, which is, in its correct form, is indeed comprised for the overwhelming majority of sincere and pious Muslims who do not participate in politics, who do not participate in elections, and who believe in trying to create a reform and to follow as carefully as they can the early community of Muslim believers. But for 50 years, the United States and Europe has been using this current, first of all, using this movement and these people, first of all, to contain Nasserism, then to contain Marxism, then to contain the influence of the Soviet Union, then to contain Shiism, then to contain the Shi'i in Iraq, then to defeat the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, to contain the rise of Hezbollah in Lebanon, and even today now is being used in Afghanistan for such purposes. And the misuse and the abuse of an apolitical group in this way has in fact resulted in a very clear process of all movements that start by being apolitical, genuinely reformist, fracturing, splintering, forming dissidents on dissidents after dissidents, as they are subjected to pressures and they are subjected to the political stresses of being used, often in terms of the interests of the West. And as they move into the process of being used in this way, these pious people look around them and see the world increasingly in terms of what befell the Muslim world earlier, during another dark period of history, when the Mongols swept into the Muslim world, destroyed the cities, burnt the libraries, sacked Baghdad, and put a Mongol as a caliph who was converted to Islam. And they see this parallel, and when they see, they look at Iraq now under occupation forces, no longer Mongol, but Western occupation forces. When they see the Shi in the seat of government in Baghdad, where the caliph was before, they see the parallels with this period, and they revert very quickly to the authority and the thinking of that time, which many of you may have heard of, the great scholar, the soldier, Ibn Taymiyyah. Ibn Taymiyyah was a man who founded, if you like, Salafism, the Saudi orientation of Salafism. And in doing so, he blamed and found the roots of the Islamic misfortune in all these new areas that had come. Shiism, Sufism, mysticism, all of these elements were the great danger that faced it. And he called for a jihad against these elements, against Sufis, against the Shi, against those who went to the graves of their forebears, as the dangers that had befallen. He called for jihad against the Mongol impostors on the caliphate, and he also called for a ban on philosophy and reasoning, which lasted in Sunni Islam until the present period. It was a narrow, literalist, dogmatic form of Islam, which has been roots and have still found its place today. And what is the paradox of this situation is, of course, that the misuse of these apolitical Salafists in this way. We have seen the migration under the pressures of the political events that are in the region, seen them migrate first, of course, to Ibn Taymiyyah and to something that is both political and very militant. And, of course, from there, the migration, the fractions, the splinters move further. And from there, they end up as followers, as Zarqawi. And the great paradox for the West, effectively, is that for a West that boasts of the Enlightenment, we end up on the wrong side of this equation. We end up, if you like, in terms of our paradigm of moderates and extremists, we end up on the side of literalism and dogma and narrow-minded anti-heterodox belief in the interests of accusing or describing the non-dogmatic, the non-literalists, the reasoning Islam of the other movements as the extremists. And I would say, therefore, to you that the West fundamentally has the wrong moderates and the wrong extremists, that we have ended up on the side not of philosophy and reasoning and thinking, but on the side of literalism and dogma. It is perhaps no surprise that a dogmatic and literalist West has actually given birth to literalism and dogmatism and Islam in the Western search for a docile and acceptable form of political Islam by which to contain the threats that it sees to itself. But in doing this, it has effectively hollowed out the center of Islam. It has hollowed out the extent of Islam, left it dispersed, and left the Middle East a very much more dangerous and violent place as a consequence. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alistair, and I'm going to ask Amjad to comment before we open it up.
I'm going to try to keep my comments brief, but one thing, listening to Alistair, and I've listened to Alistair a lot because we often have to deal with each other. I was in charge of the security file for the Palestinian negotiations from 2000 to 2003, and Alistair was Javier Solana's envoy at the time and working in the region. And all of our conversations, as I recall, were entirely about what to do about the Israeli destruction of the U.S.-trained Palestinian security services back in 2002, when the Palestinian security services then were no longer protecting Israeli interests in the occupied territory to the degree that Israel demanded any longer. And I realized that I could have been having much more interesting conversations with you over all those times we were together, much deeper conversations than simply how to stop the fighting that was taking place in Bethlehem or any of the other ceasefires you were responsible for organizing. Everything that you said actually resonated with me, but it reminded me of my very first day in a religious studies course in college. Before I became a lawyer, I actually was studying religious studies and comparative religious studies. And I had a professor at the University of Virginia, who some of you know, and he had studied in Qom and in Najaf, and he had studied with Khatami and others. And one of the first questions that he asked me in the class, I was the only Muslim who happened to be in class, and he said, "Well, Amjad, you're a Muslim. What is the point of being a human being as a Muslim on earth? What is it that you're supposed to do?" And I was 18 years old and completely unprepared for the question. Pray? And he said no. And then he went on with the course, and then the next day he asked me, the next time we had a class, he asked me the same question. He said, "Have you thought about it?" And I said, is it to be good to your neighbor? Is it to be good?" And he said, "No, you haven't been thinking about it." The third time he asked me, I said, I don't know. Just tell me what it is." And he actually said, "To create a just social order." And I was fascinated. I mean, that answer, this made me switch. It made me decide that my major was going to be religious studies, just because I was fascinated that would be the answer to a religious question. And at the time, this was at the time of the Iranian Revolution, actually. And so what was fascinating to me then was how Americans were beginning to define what they wanted to call an orthodox Islam. Because among Muslims, there's no one to actually declare what is orthodox. There's no church, there's no Pope figure, even among Shia with the system of jurisprudence and the Ayatollah structure that they have, that too is still not determinative. I mean, you can have one Ayatollah disagree with another Ayatollah, and it's up to the people to determine which one they're going to follow. So there's not actually somebody who can say, this is Islam or that is Islam. But in the United States, we've been fascinated about determining, in fact, what is Islam, and then determining that it's contradictory to our interests and therefore must be fought. Frank Gaffney was here last week having a debate with Steve Clemens, and you can still catch it on the Washington Note on Steve's blog. And it was a very lively interaction. It was for a good cause, to raise money for research on leukemia. And Frank, and I'm paraphrasing, said something like, "The problem is that authoritative Islam basically calls for the destruction of America." And obviously, Frank had to go to great lengths to pick and choose. I mean, he obviously is reading Zawahiri day and night in order to determine that orthodox Islam, in fact, determines this. And what you've pointed out is something that I think many Muslims have already noticed. If you want to generalize the Muslim world, you actually break it up into two groups. And it's a generalization because people slide in and out and along a spectrum. But one group is the one that the United States has in the past found most amenable to be allied with. It's an Islam that's politically quiescent. It's an Islam that could be mobilized against, at the time, what was considered godless communism in Afghanistan. It was misogynistic, yes, but that wasn't a priority for the United States. It was concerned with personal salvation of Muslims, but it was not concerned with social justice. It was concerned with implementation of traditional law, which Muslims in any given community consider Sharia law. So what people in the Swat Valley consider Sharia law is something that people in Tunisia would not at all recognize as Sharia law. What people in Iran might find to be Sharia is not going to be necessarily the same as, of course, what people in Saudi Arabia find to be Sharia. So it, whenever context they were in, they were demanding the implementation of Sharia. They were not so concerned with the form of government. They were not so concerned with the social contract that the people would have with the ruler. It was, as you said, dogmatic. It was anti-rational. It was anti-philosophical. And in many ways, it was counter-revolutionary. And at the same time that the Iranians were having their revolution, 2 years later, we were supporting Gulbuddin Hikmatyar in Afghanistan and not so much supporting Ahmad Shah Massoud in Afghanistan. So we couldn't even differentiate within this spectrum among those that we hope would be politically quiescent. We weren't even differentiating among those who had views that would be considered more consistent with American or Western values. This was in opposition to what was obviously a very rebellious republicanism. It was a form of Islam that demanded representative government in a Western sense. It demanded representative government, and whether it, the roots are were already within Islam or not, it's certainly something that Westerners could identify with. The idea of a regular system of election to choose the leaders who would choose the laws that the people would be run by, that attempted to combine traditional Islamic jurisprudence but considered it an ongoing affair. So they did not consider Islamic jurisprudence something that had stopped 2,000 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, or 900 years ago. It was something that had to be debated and discussed, and it was an ongoing affair and had to be discussed even within the legal structures of the state, and accepted the modern nation state system and the legitimacy of it. And it said that Muslims not only had the responsibility to pray and fast, pay the zakat, the tax, and bear witness to God and perform the pilgrimage, but that they also had a responsibility to make a better world. And said that rebellion to injustice, even if the injustice was committed by a Muslim leader, was something necessary for Muslims to engage in. Now, if we take out two historical realities, one, that the U.S. was supporting authoritarian regimes in the Muslim world, and two, that the U.S. was supporting Israel's occupation of Arab lands, if we take those two things out, which side of that equation would we normally, you would think, have sided with? Which side of that Muslim debate would we have come out on the side of if it wasn't for these two distorting facts? And I would argue that we would have come out most likely on the side that wanted republican forms of government and general systems of modern states and an ongoing and vibrant reevaluation, a constant reevaluation of Islamic law. Now, partly we couldn't do this because the resistance to injustice that these people were engaged in ended up oftentimes being aimed at us. And so now I want to take it very quickly to the Palestinian context and maybe lead it up to the questioning that we're going to do, and maybe a little bit of the Lebanese context. Israel is not the only catalyst for the way Palestinians or Lebanese or Muslims in the world see the world. Israel is a primary catalyst, but it's not the only one. We also learn and watch how each other's successes and relative failures work. And so there has been, besides the ideological and the intellectual ferment that you've described, I think, there's also been a very pragmatic and practical response to seeing how certain efforts have succeeded or have failed. So the Palestinians, for example, looked at the PLO in Lebanon and then looked at Hezbollah in Lebanon and could compare which one was more successful and which one had failed. The Hamas could look at Islamic Jihad in the occupied territory and compare it to its own Muslim, more quiescent brand of personal salvation and say, well, actually, that's actually taking up a lot of the political space. People are moving over to that. People are more excited about the resistance that Islamic Jihad is engaged in. and Fatah was not engaged in that, so it wasn't actually a factor. So Hamas's response was even more a response to another Palestinian Islamist group than maybe it was originally to Fatah. And if both Hamas and the PLO, for example, become failed models for Palestinians, well, which model then? And that's something that we haven't actually, I think, as the United States, figured, because we've already led to the failure of the PLO. And we're working hard to try to make sure that the Hamas system fails as well. And what we haven't explained to anybody, and we certainly haven't explained to the Palestinians, and I don't think we know the answer for ourselves, is then what? Then what model would exist? What model would the Palestinians have to look for? Now, I would say that Hamas potentially falls into the second grouping of Islamists. Al-Qaeda, of course, falls into that first group. Iran, Turkey, Malaysia, Indonesia, all, I think, roughly fall into that second group, countries that accept that they have modern democratic state systems of government, but they consider them Islamic. Then you have systems like Saudi Arabia and some other Arab states, which obviously fall into the first category. Pakistan is in between because it has both systems vying for control within the country. So we have a system, you know, we have the Taliban obviously struggling for, and the Taliban's allies in the Pakistani government obviously struggling for one form of government in Pakistan, but there's also a very vibrant demand in Pakistan for a modern democratic state, and which they also consider to be completely in line with Islamic principles. So I want to leave it at this. Maybe the United States needs to have a new criteria for how we deal, or for how we define and how we deal with Islamist movements. It can't be, how does this Islamist movement respond to Israel's occupation of Arab territory? There isn't a Muslim who's going to support or engage in support for Israel's occupation of Arab territory. So there's not, we're never going to find the group that's going to succeed in supporting that. But what if the criteria was based more on the values that the United States is trying to promote within our own country and outside the country? What if we look at Islamist groups and look for the ones that call for representative democracy and look for the ones that are hoping for a caliphate-like dictatorship? What if we look at the ones that are calling or accept, at least in theory, the equality of all citizens before the state, even if it accepts some religious priority by God over individual salvation, it accepts that before the state, all individuals are equal, versus those that want to create a dhimmi system or those that want to have a tiered system of rights for people of different faiths or different genders? Does it accept the legitimacy of state structures, like the nation-state structure, or does it believe that the international order in and of itself is invalid and can be overthrown or can be opposed? And if we had those criteria, how then would we look at Iran? How would we look at Hamas? How would we look at Hezbollah? How would we look at groups in Iraq, etc.? And I'll leave it at that, and I think we can have a discussion now.
Well, I'll open it up, and if no one has questions, then I'll ask Alistair a question, but if people do, then I'd rather not. Helena? And if there are others, then we'll take more than one at once.
Hi, nice to see you, Alistair. It's Helena Cobbin. I think this is probably the first time in many, many years that the name of Martin Heidegger has been invoked in a think tank discussion in Washington, D.C. So I want to congratulate you on that. And I would have added Habermas to the mix, but we can discuss that afterwards. I think it was really excellent that you remind us both that there are different forms of modernism, so we should not talk about modernism quite simply, but talk about modernisms, because these are modern phenomena that you're writing about. And secondly, that there are Islamisms, rather than just one sort of monolithic Islamist bloc that threatens, you know, Western civilization as we know it, etc. So I think that's really helpful. I think your critique of Homo economicus as created by those, you know, unmarried Protestant Anglican priests back in the 18th century is really excellent. Of course, none of them ever had to wash their own socks or raise their own children. So, you know, quite naturally, the idea that a person could be self-sufficient was attractive to them. Some of the best communitarian critique of that idea comes from feminist communitarian philosophers, including Sheila Benhabib, who is a Turkish-American philosopher of great distinction. So, I mean, I think drawing some of these things together is really helpful when you're encountering, as you have done, at many different levels, people from these movements. A question really about the issue of women's rights, which you didn't mention, Amjad just touched on briefly in terms of the misogyny in some of the fundamentalisms. I mean, I have noticed in my encounters with Hamas and Hezbollah that they have very different attitudes toward the role of women socially and in the organizations. And you see women who have been very well educated and brought up within the organization and running for parliament, for example, in Hamas and winning. And you don't see that in Hezbollah. How do you describe that kind of a difference between the two movements?
Yes, I think when you talk about going back, first of all, to your point about the philosophical element, I quite agree. I really should have included more. I say that because, you know, quite often this is described as a clash of civilizations. And what I was trying to illustrate is that many of these trends of thinking are clearly both in the West, but are seen to have relevance, of course, that transcends this sort of sectarian divide. So that if you take a presidential or former presidential candidate in the Iranian elections, like President Hatami, he is not only a great scholar of Islam, but he's also a great scholar of Habermas. And of the Frankfurt School as well. So there is, in fact, a real sense of correspondence that takes place with some of these elements of thinking. And I think it's important to get away and understand that there is that, not only in philosophy and in psychology as well. In fact, it's more pronounced perhaps in psychology than it is in modern Christianity in some ways. When you go into the question of gender and Islamism, in fact, in the book, I try to explain at some length why I didn't deal with it in terms of the revolution, partly because I don't think it's a divisive force in Islam in terms of the principles of the revolution. Although, of course, the role of women in that is something that is a question of much discussion. But it is something that is, in all societies, the relationships between, it seems to me, between men and women are something that are incredibly intractable to change. That when you look at what has changed over the period between Medina and today, that actually you find very little has changed over this period. That the depth of the sort of traditional practices that continue is very strong. However, there is a very flourishing form of Islamism within a feminism within Islamism, which does go back because it's quite clear in terms of the Quran was it extremely. Was a revolutionary document in terms of its treatment of women, not only in terms of the question of changing the laws, which was incredibly advanced in this at that time, but also in very clearly stating the equality between men and women. Much of that teaching, it seems to me, was hijacked by the male elite very shortly afterwards and has stayed largely hijacked by male elite, and has been further complicated by a growth of hadith, sayings of the Prophet, which seem to reinforce a different concept than the one that you saw in the Quran, which was about, if you like, separation and again about the dominance of the male elite. I think there are many Islamists who are aware and the need to tackle these, to go back, if you like, to the original spirit of the revelations of the Prophet, and to address that, and aware that there are problems both with the Hadith and with, if you like, what happened in the subsequent period. But it's going to be like in this society, in Western society. These things are very difficult to transform in the short term, and it's very difficult because there's no clear authority that can really address some of those points. But I do think it's something that deserves more attention, to look at it actually from the perspective of Islamism, and not so much look at feminism from the perspective that the Western perspective of feminism, if you like, simply projected into Islamism, but to look at it from within. And in fact, as an organization, we're in the process of commissioning a series of monographs, or they've been commissioned, we're waiting for the results, from Islamist feminists on how they see the way to take those issues forward. So I agree, it's something that is... I should add, I think, importantly, that inevitably in a short presentation you have to be rather too... there's too much clarity. I mean, there are elements of both trends in all movements. So in Hamas, you have predominantly one of the ones that I described as a non-dogmatic, non-literal, and the more rationalist approach. But there's also, of course, the literalist approach in all of these organizations. And indeed, in my interpretation, which many people probably would not share, is actually the Iranian Revolution was principally and foremostly actually a battle against literalism and dogma. And certainly Shariati, as a principal philosopher, I mean, wrote one of the books that he wrote was, you know, that it was about religion versus religion, was the title of the book. It wasn't religion versus the West. It wasn't religion versus secularism. And what he was describing was the dead, passive hand of static religion, the dogmatic religion, which he described as black Shiism, the Shiism of mourning that he saw. And it was also true of the Imam Khomeini, that he saw also the struggle as being one of a fight against literalism and against the clerical Shia of that time. When he gave his lectures at Qom afterwards, many of the clerical, the senior clerics there, would take his glass and purify the glass out of which his 11-year-old son had drunk, because he was a teacher of philosophy, a teacher of fun. And the literalists and the dogmatic in Tehran found this totally unacceptable. So it is that struggle, and gender is part of that struggle against dogma and what happened, what the male elite did to it in that period after the Prophet, I think.
Take Jay and
listen. Thank you for your presentation. I'm Jay Solomon with the Wall Street Journal. I was curious, from your perch in Beirut and your travels to London recently, if you're getting a sense on why the British broke from the U.S. and has agreed to start engaging politically again with Hezbollah, and if you see some trend out of this. I know we've got election in June. Maybe it's pre-positioning ahead of the June election, but I thought that was an interesting kind of dynamic that I don't really get a sense on why it happened.
And I'm going to take a second question, lump them together.
Melissa Maley, CNO Resources. Alistair, thank you for a very interesting presentation that certainly got us all thinking at a different and higher level. But we're in Washington, so here's the policy question. We look at Hezbollah and we ask ourselves, is Hezbollah a Lebanese actor, and can it be made constrained to just live and act in the nation-state structure, since that's our orientation? Or is it fundamentally not a nation-state actor and will then dabble across borders and interfere in Gaza. So that's our debate here. Obviously, in Lebanon, Hezbollah frames it quite differently. In your statement, your presentation, you talked about the focus upon social justice and broader concepts. What does that debate look like in the southern suburbs?
What I'm going to do is, if anyone else has a Lebanon Hezbollah question only, is your question Lebanon Hezbollah related? If anyone has a Lebanon Hezbollah question, then let's take that as well so we can...
Hi, Alistair. I enjoyed your presentation. My name is Derek Flood. I'm a freelance journalist. I covered the war in Lebanon in 2006. And after the UN-mediated ceasefire, I went to Sarifa, which is a small village in southern Lebanon. And many people might not know that the Israelis had destroyed a communist headquarters in that village as part of their overall bombardment. There had been sort of an agglomeration with Hezbollah fighting alongside Amal, also fighting alongside communist guerrillas. And the complexity of the war in southern Lebanon, which most journalists weren't able to really cover firsthand because a lot of Hezbollah minders kept people out of the direct battle line, it's much more nuanced than a lot of people realized. And I went to a funeral. I photographed a funeral with Hezbollah, Amal, and Communist Party fighters, like Guevarist fighters, all mourning and burying together. And it was much more of a, it wasn't so much about Hezbollah, it was about sort of a community.
Is there a question?
I wanted to know if you think that that's ever been reflected in the press, or if that's, or if the complexities of Lebanon often don't get outside of Lebanon.
Thank you. On the first question about the British recognition of Hezbollah, you may recall that a few months before they recognized Hezbollah, the United Kingdom, rather out of the blue, suddenly decided to add the so-called military wing of Hezbollah to the prescribed list. Apparently out of a view that it was acting against British and American troops around Basra. And then it was followed by, more recently, a very limited engagement with Hezbollah, with the Hezbollah MPs. I think there are probably two reasons that really prompted it, and that they're not as strategic as perhaps they have been portrayed. I think, first of all, the suggestion that Hezbollah was physically attacking British and American soldiers in Basra was, on reflection, probably considered to be improbable and likely at the time. And I think similarly, the British government found itself rather isolated from other European states that were indeed talking and still and are regularly in touch with Hezbollah. And then, of course, there was this upcoming elections, which are due in the beginning of May, when we may actually see, it's not clear yet, but we may see a shift and that the opposition may win, in which Hezbollah would be a partner in a new government. So I think, in a sense, it was, if I could describe it a little bit, as a housekeeping act. I think it was a bit of prudent housekeeping. And I don't think it was linked in any way to a sort of strategic decision that might, say, have wider application towards Hamas. I think the British government still remains absolutely fixed with its head dangling over its shoulder, waiting to watch what Washington does about Hamas before it makes any decision on that. So I think it was mostly, if you like, good housekeeping, prompted by a little bit of rethinking. It had actually turned out to be more symbolic than probably the British government intended it to be, and certainly caused an interest in Washington, which I personally think was a very positive outcome from perhaps a step which was taken for more limited reasons than was intended. On the question of Hezbollah and who is Hezbollah? Is it a Lebanese actor or is it an international actor? I'm actually always quite a little bit surprised where that's why that seems to be particularly controversial and a cause of such concern, and I know it is here, because it's both. It's clearly both. But that does not necessarily translate, being a Lebanese actor, which it is primarily, and an international actor, does not necessarily imply that this is something that it shouldn't be. I mean, it's quite possible and quite reasonable, like most states and most politics, they also have a dimension which they see as wider. It doesn't necessarily translate into something that should be regarded as an objectionable feature. I mean, quite clearly, the transnational character of Hezbollah can be seen, for example, in terms of the fact that nearly the whole of the Middle East comes to a stop. I mean, literally, there's no traffic on the roads in as far away as the Gulf when Hassan Nasrallah is giving a major speech. I mean, the region, if there is anyone that Muslims throughout the region, of whatever their political orientation, look to, and a major speech by Hassan Nasrallah, it just simply stops the traffic. If you want to get to the airport quickly in Doha or in one of the Gulf states, you know, do it when he's speaking on television because the roads are empty. So clearly, he has a regional reach, and of course, I mean, to expect otherwise to me would seem to be naive. We are in a new era in the Middle East for the first time probably ever. It seems, unlike in the 1920s, we do not see any imperial power that is about to intervene in our society. It is not, there's no going to be France or Britain, as in the 1920s, going to step in the void after a last Western intervention in the area. And as this Western intervention sort of slowly comes to an end and American and European influences, not quickly, but slowly ebbing out of the region, at least that's how it's perceived by most of the Islamists in the area, no one expects anyone else to step in. It's not going to be a China or Russia or anyone, not in a, they may do economically and technically, but not in a political fashion. And therefore, the struggle is going to be for the future of the region. And it's going to be a bitter and deep struggle about what is the shape and the future of Sunni Islam, what is going to be the shape of the region. And of course, it's already become a bitter and bloody struggle by those who are defending with their backs to the wall, defending the status quo. I mean, states such as Egypt and Saudi Arabia are doing anything they can to try and contain what they see as the growth of ideas that are hostile to their particular point of view. And the region is now very much divided between what is called, if you like, the resistance grouping, I mean, broadly countries such as Syria with Ghouta, a number of North African states, some of the Gulf Cooperation Council states, together with Iran and Turkey, versus the American allies of Jordan and Saudi Arabia. And the balance is tipping in that structure. So, of course, everybody in the region is playing on the wider stage, as it is playing on the domestic stage, too. And I think that's normal, and I think that is what you'd expect. But increasingly, Hezbollah is a national Lebanese, and is indeed, not only pretends, but is a national Lebanese actor primarily, even though, like everyone and every state in the region, it has its eye on the bigger area. I mean, no one sort of gets up and say, isn't it terrible Saudi Arabia, you know, is acting transnationally and has its interests in Lebanon and in all of the rest of the region. Of course it does. Everyone in the region is doing both. So I think it's really almost something that Washington should stop worrying about, because this is this is going to be the new era, I think, of a big struggle for the future of the region.
Unless Amjad wants to come in, I'm gonna.
Well, I did want to ask you just one question about Nasrallah, because in the speeches that
Well, in the speeches that filter down to the level here in Washington, of course, they're all related either to the United States or to Israel, and we don't pay attention to anything else that might that Nasrallah might be saying about anything else. When Hezbollah or when other Islamist groups, Iran at the beginning, especially after the revolution, was talking about all kinds of things, forms of government, the meaning of being a Muslim in politics and things of that nature, and then Khomeini was trying actually to actively proselytize a new system throughout the Muslim world. Is there any of that going on now, or is it all really just related to the conflict around Israel's occupations?
No. I mean, actually, that's the least, probably the conflict around Israel is probably the one that is, because there's pretty well a common view about what's happening there, and that the common view, I would say, is that it seems that Israel is unlikely to be able to make peace with its neighbors, and therefore there is an expectation that we may see further rounds of conflict within the region. But the main debate is about what is going to be the region. And of course, within that, Hassan Nasrallah has been notable in defining and trying to define a new citizenship or a commonality for the region in terms of what he calls, and I have to use the word quite carefully, is a common destiny in a resistance which maintains its own autonomy and its own identity, but which is, if you like, a common destiny of all the people. In other words, the resistance of Iraq and the resistance in Iran and the resistance of the Palestinians shares a common destiny. It doesn't share a common objectives. It doesn't share the same tools, but it shares a common destiny. And part of that is also a questioning. I know you spoke a lot about the nation state, I think there is a strong rethink of the nation state. Not surprising, people have seen and looked at what happened in Iraq and seen, you know, if this is, you know, the ideal of the Western state, both at a popular level and another level, is the way of finding a new structure which is more, seems better adequate to the needs of the modern era. And I think that is taking people back, if you like, perhaps to older structures in the region where confessional faith and ethnicity is not just simply bound by frontiers, that there can be more autonomy and a looser, more networked, flatter structure than the up-down, top-down nation-state structure.
Before Alistair starts parroting Tom Friedman.
Tom Friedman? No, that is respect.
Don't worry, I was saying it tongue-in-cheek. I'll take Jim at the back and Jim at the front.
Jim Loeb, Interpress Service. Actually, I wanted to ask a more philosophical or religious question. To the extent that you've also studied Roman Catholicism and U.S. policy vis-a-vis in modern times, how would you compare what you've described to liberation theology in the communities of the base in Latin America and how they were treated by the United States and their evolution? I mean, how is that distinct? Obviously, that's something for a much longer lecture, but do you see a major distinction between what you've described and liberation theology and the U.S. reaction there too?
Was it the same question?
It's similar. My name is Tom Getman, 25 years with World Vision and now with a consulting group. And since the three major streams of Abrahamic monotheism focus on the least, the last, and the lost. And when some of us have spent time with Fadlallah, he always makes the point. You know, you Christians have a problem, particularly liberal Christians. And when we say, well, yeah, we have lots of problems, what do you mean? He says, you don't do what's in the book. To your point about being reminded of what we all know. So, do you think that the humanitarian enterprise, where we are participating with the Abrahamic religions, could be a way forward to what you say, flattening things? Could it be that we would have a role to play that would be similar to the base movements from Latin America?
I'm going to take this one last question here.
You outlined the source of energy for the Islamic and... Oh, excuse me. My name is Thomas Ridd from SAIS. You outlined very convincingly the source of energy of the Islamic, what you called Islamic revolution, as a positive one for social justice. I just would like you, if possible, to comment on that contradiction. If for a naive outside observer, the further you veer to the extreme of the Islamists and the more extreme groups, the more injustice seems to be caused by those groups for Muslims, you know, women, minorities, all sorts of groups. How does that injustice, you know, the contradiction between injustice and the vision of justice, how does that play out?
I'm going to take this last one here, and then we're going to...
İlhan Tanır, Wild columnist for Hürriyet Daily News. You call Turkey one of the countries in the resistance class. I want to ask a question that whether recent President Obama visit Turkey, we should consider this visit in this context to winning back Turkey. That was recent.
And maybe when you address that, Alistair, and to round it off, being there, the people you're in contact with, how is the Obama presidency so far being viewed?
Just in a word.
In a word.
I'm not an expert on South America. I've lived there, but I would like to go back. I think what you raised was actually a very important thing about Catholicism. How why there should be any sort of resonance, with what's happening in the Middle East. And I'd just like to go back and point out something that when some of these terms were first used, the axis of evil, about the sense that states could fall into league with evil powers, and that they became duplicitous and their words could not be trusted, and that they curtailed the natural freedoms of human beings. The first person who actually used these terms was Oliver Cromwell, speaking in Parliament in about 1640. And of course, what he was referring to in terms of this evil power whose word could not be trusted, and its curtailment of freedoms that Anglo-Saxons normally enjoyed, was he was referring to Catholic Spain, and it was the Pope to watch as the source of this evil. And I think it underlines, therefore, in a sense of, it points, I mean, it's too long to go into it, but it does point in the direction of where, if you like, there is a commonality. Why was this so threatening to Cromwell? It was so threatening because Protestantism had begun its sort of nascent alliance with capitalism and had reinvented itself in terms of individualism, which was seen to be directly in opposition to another sacral community, that of the Roman Catholic, who did put more emphasis on social and community justice in the world at that time. Of course, things have moved on a little bit. So I think those possibly underlines the sort of roots of why there might be, if you like, some resonance, even if they're rather different in their absolutely in their structure. The second question, which was about do you do what's in the book? And I think you'll find in the book I wrote, actually, that the introduction starts off with a senior clerical philosopher saying, well, what's at the root of this problem? And what he says at the root of the problem is a divergence of view about what is a human being, what constitutes the essence of a human being. And he says that really what we have to do in order to get back to this point about the human question is to sit back and actually come and tease out some of the points about why there is now a divergence about what is the nature and the essence of a human being. And from that point that there is the possibility of convergence and agreement. So I quite agree with you that actually at the bottom of it is, call it humanism, but what I call it is the being, and the human being is important. On the question of are these ideas positive in terms of the thinking, and therefore why do we see so much injustice in practice? I haven't gone really into, tried not to go too much into what is the underlying sort of Islamic philosophy, but to say that it has been there, the intellectual tradition, for 1,000 years. But there's also been, for 1,000 years, if you like, the struggle between literalism and dogma in Islam. It's not something that has just emerged or emerged even with the Mongol invasion of Islam. It is a long story of reaction. And I think that much of what you see in terms of the forms of injustice does derive from this, the struggle of between an intellectual tradition and the tradition of transmitted knowledge, in other words, the tradition of narrow, anti-heterodox, anti-rational thinking. We have that both in Western societies as we have it in Islam. And much of the injustice comes, I believe, from the clash and the tension between these two traditions. And I just say that, I mean, and I think it's an important point you make. I don't think there's anyone who says that the, you know, this process of finding a new self in Islam is finished, or is it indeed, it's really only just begun. And of course it's going to have some strange consequences. I just add that Christianity, when it went through this process in the Dark Ages, I mentioned it started off with a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, but actually that eventually transformed within the next 50 years into a crusade, and then lasted through crusades for 200 years afterwards. So sometimes, even in the process of transformation, you do get a large element of injustice, if you like, emerging in the process. On the question of Turkey, yes, I put Turkey in the link with increasingly within the ambit of Syria and Iran. Not, I think that it's important not to see them as allies. I think we're in a new era where there are basic affinities, which does not mean that there is a sort of a formal alliance, but some basically shared views. And I think the idea of simply absolute allies in the sense is probably passing away from the region, that people can have slightly different views and different things, but share a basic, if you like, perspective on the region. And I think that Turkey has become a pivotal country in terms of its shifting of its perspective, and Gaza played an important part in that, and certainly not only at the top of Turkey. And I know there are people who say, well, you know, he only said that because he had elections to win. I think that sort of cynicism is misplaced, because I think there is an incredibly strong feeling throughout the region about what happened in Gaza, and therefore the legitimacy of resistance that emerged from that. Finally, you asked me in a word to say about the question about Obama. I think from the perspective of the Islamist groups as a whole, and I spoke to them at some time well before the elections, that they saw two things. They believed that there was a real shift in sentiment in America, particularly amongst the public, that they saw changes taking place, and they recognized that from well before the election that it was taking place. And they also saw that there was going to be a change in language and in atmospherics. I think they were much more cautious and much more careful about believing that this would translate into a radical shift in policy that would come from that, not because of a inherent, if you like, distrust in the man Obama, but more in the question of an understanding of the constraints and the pressures of an American system, which they do understand actually quite well, how difficult it is for anyone, even a president, to radically shift policy issues because of the competitive and the various balancing of interests in the West. So what they did and how they reacted to this was actually to play into this and to start engaging in the West initially with the aim of a much more limited one of starting political conversations within the region again, of starting getting away from the isolation and the politics. And they've had considerable success in actually beginning a process of restarting politics within the region. And now there is a sense of waiting to see whether Obama's initiatives, which are huge, are solely or merely language and atmospherics, or whether they will see substance. And I just conclude with one last comment on that, is I think that it's important to understand it's no longer the region that was. There is a sense, of course, amongst all Muslims that language is hugely important, and so is atmospherics, and this has been a really important and worthwhile event. But there is another feeling that is equally strong. After this period of the Israeli-Palestinian issue, nobody wants to see another peace process that is simply that of language and politics, and is underneath it simply a deceit in terms of bringing about any real solution or change. So if it is no more than, if you like, an expansion of a process, the political process industry, to the regional level, but doesn't have a real substance, I think it will be clear that language and atmosphere are not enough, simply because everybody has become so hostile, have simply had it with the sort of political process which Europeans and Americans and Israelis have been involved in, which they have clearly understood to be really based on, as they see it, on a deceit that has led to nothing in terms of a real outcome.
On that note, I'll just reflect on the fact that Israel's new foreign minister managed to get President Obama to talk about the Annapolis process, which they'd avoided doing so far. So that might have been a far more smart and calculated move on Mr. Lieberman's part than anyone was giving him credit for, because I think I would agree with you, Alistair, the last thing we need is a return to Annapolis. We've run over time. I apologise for that. I also know Alistair has to go along to another meeting, so I imagine he'll be having to make a quicker exit than we'd normally expect from speakers. But thank you all so much for joining us, and thank you, Alistair and Andrew.
Thank you very much for coming.
And the books are on sale outside.